Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, we are broadcasting but not video streaming because I'm at a different studio where we're doing editing on a new documentary. We're going to talk about how meditation and yoga can actually reverse DNA damage, and especially that damage caused from stress from Coventry University. And then we're going to take a look at other topics, including the power of the Mediterranean diet to slow down the aging process and reverse a lot of disease, and how sulforaphane in broccoli sprouts are improving glucose levels in diabetics, University of Gothenburg, which is in Sweden, and how this should be interesting to a lot of people because we have a lot of activists in this audience and physicians and nurses. There's a new compound from a plant, and I'll get into it in detail, that is more powerful than AZT against HIV. And when I saw this article from the University of Illinois, I thought, wow, they studied 4,500 plant extracts for their effect against the HIV virus. And for a moment, I thought back to when I published my textbook on AIDS, edited by Professor Jim Feast. And in it, the largest chapter in my textbook on AIDS is on natural, non-toxic ways of helping destroy HIV and stimulate the body's immune system. And this plant was in there. And in fact, many people are not aware of this, but a 1,700 of you are because you actually came to the church over in Central Park West for a whole day and night. It started at noon. It went to about 11 at night. And I flew in at the leading plant biologist dealing with viral antiviral properties from China, another gentleman from Japan, and about 17 different presenters, all scientists and physicians, who had natural, non-toxic ways of dealing with AIDS-defining illnesses. And at that place, I also handed out, if you remember, those of you who were there, I handed out the scientific references on all the natural, homeopathic, naturopathic, and holistic protocols that could help people with AIDS-defining illnesses. So all those years, that's back in 1991, here we are. And they're just now finding this, what we had been using, and getting good results. 1,200 people with full-blown AIDS treated for free at the Tri-State Healing Center and reversed their condition, improved their condition, and in 12 cases, cured their condition. So I'm going to talk about that today. It's always fun when you're so damn far ahead of the pack, and one day they catch up. From John Hopkins University School of Public Health, 19-year-olds are as sedentary as 60-year-olds. Wow. What does that mean? I'll explain. And also, diets rich in polyunsaturated fats can alter your appetite hormones, and especially among millennials, University of Georgia. And there's a lot more on health and healing today I'm going to share. But I decided not to have a guest on today so that we can have some time for talk back. I'm going to get into an issue a little later to get your response on it. We're going to have some commentaries today, one from Chris Hedges from Truthdig, The Age of Anger. We're also going to have Twilight of American Courts by a constitutional lawyer and one of the brightest legal minds in America, John Whitehead. And also from Nomi Prinz from Tom's Dispatch, Dear President Trump, breaking up the banks is not hard to do. I'm a big believer we should break up the banks and also reinstate the Glass-Steagall Act. And I'll explain why that's important for us. So, and we also have Elizabeth coming on, wherever she will be, asking me your questions. So I always look forward to seeing what questions you find important. So let's begin. And we have some audio clips we're going to play you also. We have always known that meditation relaxes you. And that's why millions, if not tens of millions of Americans on a regular basis engage in different types of meditation. And more are using yoga. But it's mainly to de-stress. Now, according to Coventry University, they have found the following, that body-mind interventions such as meditation, yoga, and tai chi, don't simply relax us. They can reverse the molecular reactions in our DNA which cause ill health and depression. The research published today in the journal Frontiers in Immunology, a major and respected peer-reviewed journal, reviews over a decade of studies analyzing how the behavior of our genes is affected by different modalities of what we call MBIs. MBIs is body-mind interventions. Experts from the universities concluded that when examined together, the 18 separate studies over 10 years with lots of people show that molecular changes which happen to the body as a result of meditation or yoga or tai chi can help your immune system, help your brain. This is just terrific news because it also puts down inflammatory markers. You've heard me talk about nuclear factor kappa B, which regulates our genes and how they express themselves, and turning on the flight or fight response when we are anxious, insecure, uncertain, angry, fearful. Any of these negative emotions turn this on automatically. It flips a switch. When that switch goes on, your DNA are adversely affected. Now, whether you like it or not, even though you face no real fight for your life, you've triggered an increasing cascade and of a molecule called the nuclear factor B, kappa B, which can be adverse. And the nuclear factor kappa B translates stress by activating genes to produce proteins called cytokines, C-I-C-Y-T-O, kines, K-I-N-E-S, cytokines. And that in turn causes inflammation at your cellular level and a reaction that is useful in a very short period of time. If you had to run to get out of harm's way or fight, you have that reaction in your body ready to help you. But if it's just a normal day and you're angry, you're in traffic, you're late, you're worried about something, you didn't have a good conversation with someone, you've just turned all that on. And that makes you at higher risk of cancer. It accelerates your aging process. And it makes you more vulnerable to depression and anxiety disorders. So, when you do just the opposite, yoga or meditation or tai chi, you are bringing down that nuclear factor kappa B, and you are bringing down, turning the flame down on the burner inside your body. And that means that everything's going to work better, especially your brain and your stress inflammatory markers. So that's brand new and good information. And also, you know what it does? For all, remember when Pat Robertson says that yoga is, yoga is something from the devil? All those people who are afraid of authentic living and real truths and universal truths, they live by these their own notions of self-righteous and frequently very angry at anyone who shares a different notion. So when you're doing yoga and you're jogging and you're juicing and you're eating healthy foods, it's all positive, and the science is there to support it. All they have on their side is dogma and personal bias. University of Gothenburg, which is in Sweden, published in Translational Medicine, Science of Translational Medicine, shows that the broccoli sprout, that's different than the broccoli, but the broccoli sprout, which is easy to sprout, you can do it yourself. Just get 1 teaspoon of broccoli seeds, and you put them in a jar, and you put maybe 3 inches of water in the jar, and you let it sit all day, and then you tip it up and you drain it out, then you rinse it off, and you put a little screen on the top so the sprout seeds don't come out, and you tilt that. You put it at an angle so they're not sitting in water, and each day, twice a day, you run water over it and then drain it out. You keep it in a dark place, and only in the last day, about day 5 or 6, you can put it on a windowsill so the chlorophyll starts to be enhanced through photosynthesis from the sun. And you have a wonderful, powerful, healing food, what we call functional food. It functions in this healing. Now, specifically, there are chemicals in the broccoli sprout. And one of those chemicals is called sulforaphane. Sol, S-U-L, fora, F-O-R-A, fane, P-H-A-N-E, sulforaphane. And it's extremely rich. It has anti-diabetic properties. It's very good for diabetics. Quote, there are strong indications this can become a valuable supplement existing in to existing medications. That was from one of the professors. So eat more sprouts. And also we know that sulforaphane in broccoli sprouts and indole-3-carbinol, which is a very powerful anti-cancer agent, is in there. And I don't go into my protocols on the air when I'm working with some because I don't want someone to think, okay, I'm just going to do that. Keep in mind, everyone I work with is unique and different, and you have to look at where they're like, where they're at in their life, where the disease is manifesting versus their wellness manifesting. So in any case, so I might have someone consuming 30 ounces of wheatgrass juice a day if they're terminal, but I would never suggest more than about 4 ounces for the average person, 2 ounces in the morning, 2 ounces in the afternoon. Same with broccoli sprouts. You have no idea how many broccoli sprouts I have people eating in a day who have Lyme's disease, chronic fatigue, and cancers, or any immune dysfunction, because the chemicals in those broccoli sprouts are really powerful for them. But one thing is for certain, if you're a diabetic or pre-diabetic, if you have an elevated fasting blood sugar level, have some broccoli sprouts. Because when you look at the mapping of the genetic sequencing changes in the liver in diabetics, 50 genes proved to play key roles. These were then matched against different substances in search of compounds that could affect these particular key genes. And lo and behold, of the 2,800 substances investigated through computer-based mathematical analysis, sulforaphane from broccoli sprouts did the task. So there's a lot of good research going on out there. In fact, next week I'm going to play you a video you have not seen. There's been no news of this in America. But there's some Israeli researchers have perfected a system where they can now go into the body non-surgically. There's no broken skin. There's no intervention. Let's say you have you've just suffered a stroke. Well, one of the problems when you suffer a stroke is you've got a blood clot in your brain. You've had an aneurysm, and that stays there. And as long as that clot stays there, the body trying to defend itself creates swelling and massive amounts of inflammatory agents, and that exacerbates killing brain cells. They can dissolve that in about 3 hours. What would have taken weeks with medications to do, and you end up paralyzed, they can do in hours. Let's say that you have bone cancer. They can dissolve the bone cancer. You can get up and walk out and, you know, go back to normal life. If you had bone cancer operation, you're looking at a week or two in the hospital, then weeks to months of recovery. Let's say you have a cancer in your ovaries. They don't do any surgery. They can dissolve that cancer. And so I'm going to be sharing on a regular basis the newest science from around the world. And you'll see things that are really remarkable that exist now. We're not talking about in the future. So I'm going to give that to you starting next week. Now we come to something from the University of Illinois. And this is a plant found throughout Southeast Asia, traditionally used to treat arthritis and rheumatism, and it contains a potent anti-HIV compound more powerful than AZT, according to a new paper published in the Journal of Natural Compounds. The chemical is what is called patentiflorin A, patentiflorina, and it's derived from the willow-leafed justicia, justicia, and was identified in a screening of more than 4,500 plant extracts for their effects against HIV virus. So it was took years in this multi-year research partnership, University of Illinois and Chicago, Hong Kong Baptist University, Vietnam Academy of Sciences and Technology. They all worked together as an international cooperative biodiversity group, and they found this. It was funded by the National Institute of Health and the National Science Foundation and U.S. Department of Agriculture. So this is good. Now, next week, I'm going to publish up online my entire chapter, over 160 pages, on natural approaches to helping people with AIDS-defining illnesses, including the natural anti-yeast, antibacterial, antiviral, anti-parasitic properties of different herbs and botanicals. And so anyone you know who is suffering from these immune-related conditions, now you have a whole lot of material at your disposal, and I'll also include the latest on this one. But there are actually plants out there that are even more powerful, and none of these are toxic. None are toxic. So that'll come next week. But I'm glad they did this research. And finally, John Hopkins University School of Public Health did a study which is published in Preventive Medicine, and it looked at young people, 19-year-olds. And physical activity among children and teens is lower than previously thought. In another surprise finding, young adults after the age of 20 show the only increases in activity over the lifespan, suggesting that, wow, we have an entire generation of people who are simply not going to live that long. Because on a scale of 1 to 100, 100 being ideal choices for a longer life, perfect diet, I mean perfection, juicing and the raw food combinations with the slightly cooked living foods, add that in at about 15%, more or less. But exercise is equal to that. So right there, if you're not exercising, you've just taken a big section of what caused you to stay alive. So what they're finding is that this was just published, that we have an epidemic, quote, heightened concern that exercise deficits are contributing to a growing obesity epidemic, particularly among children and teens. Activity levels at the end of adolescence were alarmingly low. By the age of 19, they were comparable to 60-year-olds. For school-aged children, the primary window for activity was the afternoon between 2 and 6 p.m. So the big question is, how do we modify daily exercise schedules in schools, for example, to be more conducive to increasing physical activity? I think that's relatively simple. Why don't we do something really radical and revolutionary that we've never done before in American history? Why not have recess and playgrounds? Oh, we did that, and it worked. And they allow kids to go out and yell and scream and, you know, and run around and chase each other and play for 10, 15 minutes a couple times a day. And then we thought it was kind of obsolete, and so we got rid of it. Big mistake. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of the syndicated stations carrying our program and all the people listening throughout the world. Every day we try to select articles, documentaries, calls to action that empower people, that shows you what we consider a more objective and honest look at every problem. Last evening I went down to Lincoln Center to look at some of the documentaries and their a Human Rights Film Festival, and it's a good film festival, and generally they select really outstanding films, and I have a lot of respect as a documentarian myself for what goes into these people making these films. And I saw one that dealt with the surveillance state. And in this particular film, they showed a scene in where there was a confrontation. I believe it was down in Brazil. It was because of the soccer, a gigantic world game that's huge all over the world. It's the biggest sports event in the world, watched, and people love it all over. We're not big into that in the United States, but boy, they are elsewhere. But in the process of making the stadium in this complex for this to be held there, they had to displace over 150,000 more or less people without getting them new and nicer places and taking care of their standard of living. So there were protests. And there's a group called the Black Ninja, and these are social activists who film everything because we're now living in a complete, total surveillance state. In fact, you may not be aware of it, but your cell phone can be turned on, you can be filmed, your cell phone can hear everything you're saying and monitor exactly where you're at, every movement. The same is true with your computer. Your computer, if you look at the top and run your finger across it, you'll find a little hole. They're watching and listening to everything going on. But what if you have a computer in your bedroom? You don't want the world knowing what you're doing in the privacy of your own home, even if you did nothing. I mean, how many people in the daytime just walk around in their underwear or naked? That's your business. What you do in the privacy of your own home should not be for any spying person to look at, especially since there's multiple agencies spying all at the same time on everything you do, everything you buy, they're looking at. So in any case, to put some perspective to this, all these young people were filming every demonstration from different angles and windows. And so in one particular scene, a firebomb went off, Molotov cocktail, and then the police used that as an excuse to charge and beat people up and shoot rubber bullets at them and mace them. But then they tackled one guy, and they broadcast on the news. It showed on the news, this is the man who threw the firebomb. And, of course, you could imagine what that does to someone's reputation and their family's reputation if you're called out for being the person who threw the firebomb. So what happens is a lawyer put the word out, if anyone has any information that can show this person didn't have a backpack on, that's what they said. You know, the police said he had a backpack and took a firebomb, Molotov cocktail out of his backpack and threw it. Let us know. Well, suddenly all these people began to communicate instantaneously, and in their instantaneous communication from different angles of different windows in that whole area, they showed that the guy had no backpack. So right away, he's innocent. They show he never threw anything. He never fought anything. He was in the front line, but he did nothing except engage in a peaceful demonstration. But someone did film the guy who did have a backpack, put it on the ground, took the Molotov cocktail off, threw it, and then saw him taking off with another person. Now, here's what's interesting. About a block away, that person who did have the backpack gave the backpack off and then was stopped by police, and you can hear him say as the guy zooms in, I'm the police, and shows someone his ID, and then the police let him through. Well, suddenly this went viral. So now they found the guy who was arrested is innocent. They found the guy who is guilty is a member of the police, a provocateur, agent provocateur. And when they confronted the guy, because now they're all over him, they're up in his face saying, you know, filming him, you're a cop, you're here, why'd you do this, blah, 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 you know, you're a disgrace. So now the media has to apologize. And I thought it was an extraordinarily well-done scene, and I commend the director, I commend the producer for selecting that. And now think of it this way. Here's what they didn't do. Not once in the film did they mention that the leading cyber attack agencies in the world are in the United States, the CIA and our 17 different security agencies, Great Britain, Australia, Canada, France. These are the leading provocateurs where they go in, not just surveil everything illegally. Do you remember when Clapper is now being called a hero for, you know, standing up on issues? Was that the same James Clapper that got up and lied before the world and Congress and committed perjury when he said, is there any mass surveillance? No. And he knew damn well there was. And yet nothing happens to him because of the politics of it. But here's what was not discussed and what I would have done. This is no condemnation of the director. I thought he did a very good job. But I would have focused upon what does it mean when Canada and the United States, Great Britain, Australia are not only doing this, but they're also planting malware and in other countries, sovereign countries, computer systems, as they did in Iran. And then the consequences of that to the people. And not even a word about this. But also, the one corrections I would have in doing scholarship and research, when you were filming the people in Syria and showing how, you know, Assad bombed his own people. Assad's no angel. And I'm not a fan of Assad, but I am saying that the United States engaged illegally, covertly, spending over $100 million to fund the White Helmets, which is a terrorist organization, at the same time funding the provocateurs who went into one community. Sharpshooters got on roofs. These are the so-called moderate terrorists that we supported and Great Britain supported. And then when there was a student protest that they activated on the ground, when Saddam's troops came, they killed them, six of them, I believe it was. And we had that from firsthand reports of one of the people we work with, a legitimate, honest reporter. And so my suggestion is don't fall into the trap of many on the left and many on Pacifica, who unfortunately, and in my opinion to their shame, have supported neoliberalism and colonialism and imperialism, all wrapped up in this wonderful, cheesy-smelling, you know, I am a good liberal, so don't criticize me. When you condemn Gaddafi and you destroyed a country, and you condemn Syria and you destroyed a country, and when you condemn what went on in Russia as if it was all Russia's fault in Ukraine, and without looking at the facts, and you don't condemn Honduras for the coup that occurred there under Hillary Clinton, then do you have any moral or legal responsibility for supporting the death and destruction of tens of millions of people, innocent people? Because look at Libya, look at Syria, look at Honduras, and the mere fact that someone calls themselves a liberal today doesn't cut it. I think that we should have stopped listening to both liberals and conservatives, Republicans, Democrats, and look for people who actually are just human beings speaking the truth without having to moniker themselves and this kind of rhetoric. And that was the one thing I had hoped that the film would have. In any case, we need more films on human rights. We need films that show what's wrong with the World Trade Organization, the international organizations like the International Bank of Settlements, the most powerful financial institution in the world that controls all the other banks in the world. We need an expose, a real expose of the Federal Reserve. We need a real expose of the FDA, the history of the FBI, the history of the CIA, the history of the National Security Agency. We need real exposés on the drugging of our children and the politics of favoritism in Washington. And I'm hopeful that people in this audience will take it upon themselves to get into that. And at some point in the future, probably in the fall, when I finish my two current documentaries, I'll do a workshop and help wherever I can any of these. In fact, on some of the documentaries, I'm even willing to put up some of the funding if I see that the project is important and you have the expertise to do it, to see that more projects get done. I believe that the more we watch good documentaries, and this was a good documentary last night, I really recommend people see it, that this will help change a lot of people, especially younger people. And we need younger people more engaged. Coming up this week, Rabbi Michael Lerner, one of the nation's leading Jewish intellectuals and spiritual political activists, along with Professor Jim Garrison, founder of the Ubiquity University and Wisdom School of Graduate Studies, and he was a co-founder with Mikhail Gorbachev of the Gorbachev Foundation and State of the World Forum, they're going to be on talking about something we really need on Tuesday on the Progressive Commentary Hour, a humanistic and spiritual valued philosophy towards a new progressive movement to meet the challenges and threats of our times, but outside of the existing political movement. And I'll go into great depth why I believe that none of our existing political movements can make any difference. In fact, we're going to talk about how in a country of over 130 million voters voting, not just 1 million voted for Jill Stein, who did have the answers, would have solved the problems, and why. What's wrong? What are people afraid of? So we're going to deal with that. I also have to deal with China. China's a police state. If you think you got freedom in China, think again. And if you want real reality check, go to Tibet and see how the Tibetans are living with China ruling them. But China is doing something that's interesting. They're creating the largest public project in the world with a railroad that's going to go across about half the globe. Now, how are they going to do that? It's about $6 trillion. But I'm going to go into it and show what they're doing, and we can't even get an Amtrak train to work on time. Why don't we have massive public spending, which we can afford, to put commuter trains going from New York to Los Angeles and every crisscross in the country, but the big trains that the Germans are using now and the Japanese use now that are zero polluters. They get you there in time so we don't have to fly. We don't have to take cars. And then how about all the other things we could do that other countries are doing? We're not. So I'm going to deal with that. And then we have Professor Robert Thurman coming on, a distinguished Buddhism professor, scholar, Columbia University. And we're going to have him on as part of our conversation with Remarkable Minds with Dr. Cleve Hamilton, professor of public ethics at Charles Sturt University in Australia, talking about climate change. And we're going to investigate what we have to do to care more as a society so we just don't talk about things, we actually do things. And then also I'm going to have a conversation next week on genetics and the microbiomes, and what's happening with Robert DeSalle, curator of entomology at the Sackler Institute for Comparative Genomics. So that's next week. We try to bring you people that you wouldn't hear on issues that are not being discussed in ways that hopefully can make a difference. And this Sunday, 7 p.m., my webinar on reversing brain aging. It starts at 7 o'clock. And by the way, I'm going to get into something you have not heard about. And that is a whole new field that's got a lot of good work going on called geroprotectors and artificial intelligence. So it de-ages the cells in the brain. And it's all about activating signaling pathways. The geroprotectors represent a whole new advance in healthy aging. So I'd like to bring you stuff that's a lot ahead, plus the AMPK promoting longevity and helping with a lot of conditions and specific protocols. 7 o'clock, go to GaryNall.com for more on that. And now let's say hello before we go to some of our commentaries. Let's go over and say hello to Elizabeth, who's standing by. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, Gary. How are you? It's great to see so many questions coming in. Here's one in particular. Ronald wrote in to say that his father talked with him about how he was a devotee of Carlton Fredericks and Adele Davis, and this was during the 60s and 70s. And then along came you, Gary Null, in 1970s. But because you were so young, he didn't pay much attention to you. It was only when Carlton Fredericks and Adele Davis died that he listened and realized that you represented an entirely new, holistic approach to how we look at wellness and health. He felt increasing regret that he had wasted 25 years of his life on a high-protein diet, taking no exercise, not being able to deal with stress appropriately, and continuing to smoke because, for one, Carlton Frederick smoked. Then he took the opportunity to come across to your retreat at Grosinger's, and he came back overwhelmed. It was as if you had opened up a door in his mind, his son is saying. He thought this young man is opening us up to an entirely new field of mind and body experience. Well, today his father is 92. He's very active. He's without illness. And he feels he's still alive because he's followed those principles. So that was a nice email that I wanted to read on the air to you.
He is wrong in one respect. I just want to correct him on that. I did not, in any way, shape, or form, create anything new when it came to mind, body, spiritual evolution. I am merely one of its proponents. There were greater people than me who ushered this in. You could go back to the vitalist of the 17th and 18th century. Voltaire was a vitalist, for example. But even in the United States and in Mexico, you had a vitalist known as Edmund Seki. Seki is not S-A-K-A-Y, it's S-Z-E-K-E-L-Y. He was from Transylvania, and in the 1920s, he was already putting together the concept that what we were eating was unhealthy, our lack of exercise was non-invigorating, and what we were thinking on, just staying focused on daily rituals without looking up ahead of us and saying, what's the likely outcome of these rituals I'm engaged in? So he came to the United States, and he was one of about six major, what I would call vitalist teachers at that time. Bernard McFadden was one about the same time. And before him was Dr. Kellogg of the Kellogg's Battle Creek, Michigan. And Seki was unique, and he would get people to eat a raw foods diet wherever possible. They grew food organically. He had what today we would call healthy communes where people would come. And down in Mexico, they have one. I believe it's still there that his daughter runs or did run. And all the leading other vitalists like Scott and Helen Nearing were all friends. They all knew each other. Now, he was different than the Carlton Fredericks. Carlton Fredericks was not a vitalist. Carlton Fredericks was I never will forget the time I had lunch with Carlton Fredericks, the one and only time at his insistence, and he wanted me to fall in line. You know, yeah, kid, you got a best-selling book, and you're on Mike Douglas and Merv Griffin, and you're Johnny Carson, but don't take that seriously because that can come and go real fast, let me tell you that. So what is it? What's your motive? And I said, well, my motive is to help people. And he said, you think I'm that naive? And we're having lunch, and I'm having a salad, and he's having a hamburger with smoking a cigarette, drinking coffee with sugar in it, eating white bread. And I'm saying to myself, I'm just being thoughtful and courteous, man, you know, do you not see any contradiction in your approach? And the health movement, when I got into it, was like a closed shop. Everybody was old, and they all had your area was either high-protein diet or it was B-complex or something like that. No one was into meditation. No one was into exercise. No one was into stress management. It was very commodified. And that's why I wanted nothing more to do with it and have not to this day had anything to do. You'll never see me at any of their conventions. You won't see me ever. I get invited. I don't go because I don't believe in taking one small piece of a puzzle and trying to make it the entirety of a reality because it's not. But at the same time that was going on, there were people up in Livingston Manor who would go for sunbathing and yoga and meditation and Tai Chi, the very thing I talked about at the beginning of the program, they were doing in the United States. And they had these centers all across the country. And Edward Seki had one. And I was asked to meet him at least three times. The trouble is I was on tour and didn't have a chance to meet him. I believe that he was with Scott Nearing, and I knew Helen and Scott Nearing, and I couldn't get back. He died in 1979 at about 75 years old. He wasn't that old, but one of the things he did that I thought was really creative, I believe it was down in Mexico, he would say, each day you must engage in three things. You must first start off by honoring your body. Go for a nice, brisk walk up in the hills. Honor your mind by meditating on the issues that are important in life, and then honor society, honor your community by giving service to your community. So give something back. And he would write famous philosophy quotes from the great philosophers throughout time on rocks. And so when you're taking your walk, you might, the moment you came to one of those quotes, you were supposed to stop, read it, and reflect on it, and it's in nature in that moment. He was a vitalist. He believed that all things engaged in energy exchange, including the trees. Water was very important to him. He'd actually do lectures in water, you know, like in a stream and a shallow river. He was way ahead of the world. I mean, he was right up there with Nietzsche, but in a far happier and more spiritual place than Nietzsche. And so imagine spending a half a morning walking through the woods and you come across a saying from one of the great minds throughout history, and you stop and you must reflect upon that.
That's wonderful.
And so when someone makes a statement, and I see that I'm merely one of the people who have benefited from a lot of people who came before me, then I believe we must always honor those people for the deeds that they engaged in, because a lot of people today wouldn't know who they are. Next question. One more question.
Okay, thank you. This is from Carol Pessin. She says, hi, Gary. She has leg cramps at night and is wondering if you could give her some advice on that, please.
Depends upon what the leg cramps are from. She should have a medical evaluation to make sure it's not intermittent claudication. If the cramp is in the calf, that's frequently from intermittent claudication, poor circulation, thickening of the blood, might be a precursor of thrombosis, especially if you have venous clots. So first get it evaluated so you know what you're dealing with. And then look at the foods, like beet juice helps, cabbage juice helps, watermelon and lemon juice together help. Cayenne pepper is very important at a high heat unit. Magnesium is the single most important thing to relieve leg cramps at night, if they're just cramps because of lack of buildup of lactic acid, and you have too much lactic acid buildup and lack of lymphatic flow. That's where I would start. Okay?
Thank you very much. Great.
Okay. Take care.
Okay.
Bye.
Thanks. Bye.
Now I'm going to play you a clip to get into something I think is important. Please listen up. We got an audio clip for you right now. And this is from CNN playing a clip about a small community, about 500 people, and they live on like an extension of an island, and it's sinking. It's being flooded. So they're definitely being impacted by the climate. Just listen to this, please.
We're running out of land to give up. We don't have the time to fool with.
Residents of Tangier, Virginia, don't have time to wait for Washington to debate climate change.
I agree with science, but our problem is our communities eroding away.
Yeah, it's always in the back of your mind.
Always.
They live fewer than 100 miles from the White House on an island in the middle of the Chesapeake Bay. Population, about 450. Area, just 1.3 square miles and shrinking. During severe weather, such as Superstorm Sandy in 2012, the island is buried under feet of water. The Army Corps of Engineers tell CNN erosion and rising sea levels alone will make this historic crabbing community uninhabitable in as little as 20 years. Adding that, quote, a major storm event striking the island directly could cause abandonment sooner. It's a heartbreaking prospect rejected by many locals whose families have been living and fishing off the island since the 18th century.
What I tell our citizens as mayor, do not lose hope.
In a small room in the Old Town Clinic, Mayor James Uker Eskridge meets daily with fellow lifelong residents to discuss the island's fate.
There are people out there that say, we'll just move. Why do you live here?
That's a silly statement for them. Silly statement. You don't just leave your home.
We're savable.
Yes,
right
we
now.
Are.
We're right very now, savable, we're savable right now. Yeah, Donald Trump, if you see this, I mean, whatever you can do, we welcome any help you can give us.
Donald Trump received 87% of the island's presidential votes last November. Some of Tangier's locals say they care less about his controversial view on climate change and more about his views on infrastructure.
He's cutting the regulations.
I believe he's concerned about our safety.
The Army Corps of Engineers will begin building a jetty to protect the harbor here next year, but the rest of the island will need a far larger and more expensive barrier to survive.
He's going to cut down on the time it takes to study something. We've been studied to death. We just need something done.
Mapping data shows how rapidly the shoreline has waned in the past, and without significant intervention, the small American town will continue to disappear into the bay at the rate of 16 feet a year in some places.
So what could Tangier Island look like for future generations if the predictions do come true? Well, we're about to go find out at a place called the Upards.
Carol Pruitt Moore is a seventh generation islander. She takes this short boat ride from the main island every day to walk along an abandoned shoreline and reflect on the past.
As recently as the 1920s, an entire community lived right here. We're only about a mile and a half from Tangier, and this is all that's left of the Upperds. What do you think about when you come here every day and take your walk?
Well, I mean, you know, like when I find pieces of glass and pottery, I try to imagine the people who may have used them and, you know, what their lives were like.
So here we have people living on Tangier Island in Virginia. And if you saw the video part, you would see it's nice homes, and it's a long-term community. Then you have the reality of them not accepting climate change and the rising of the sea levels. And so here's my question, and I'm going to take some calls in a few moments on TalkBack, 888-874-4888. What would you suggest? We have some choices because it's not just going to be on Tangiers. It's virtually the entire South Florida coast, including Miami and the Keys. It is also in the Delaware River, or the Delaware Bay and Basin. It's New York City, Lower Manhattan specifically. We're going to get flooded. It's not, are we going to flood? It's how quickly it's going to occur. And my concern is, and we're having the guest I had on the other day from Oxford University back on, because we're going to do an hour, because what I didn't have a chance to ask him, I ran out of time, was how long do you see before things get into so many negative feedback loops that nothing can change? And he's going to say it's just a matter of a couple of years before we start seeing this happen. It's going to happen this summer. And others agree. We're not prepared for any of this. We don't even want to hear this. This is the news that jars us. But here's the reality. I'm going to share the latest on this from those who would deny the significance. This is from the Weather Underground, from Dr. Jeff Masters, quote, historic heat wave sweeps Asia, Middle East, and Europe. And it said the June has brought one of the most extraordinary heat waves in world history to Asia, the Middle East, and Europe. The mercury shot up to an astonishing 53 centigrade. By the way, that's 120 degrees Fahrenheit. At Turbat in Pakistan, and then making it the Earth's hottest temperature ever recorded in the month of May, and one of the Earth's top five hottest reliably measured temperatures on record for any month. Both Pakistan and Oman tied their all-time national heat records for any month during the heat wave, and all-time national heat rate records for the month of May were set in Iran, Norway, and Australia, and Austria as well. And so what you're looking at is temperatures in the 120s or 130s right now. And so that's just one of them. And when I look around at the United Arab Emirates, when I look at Saudi Arabia, they had 118 degrees was recorded. And another had 127 degrees. So when you have that kind of heat, you have to use an enormous amount of resources to cool it down. And that means you're adding to the pollution. And that means that we're not dealing with the problem. Well, if you live in a country that is up to this point, then the richest country in the world, by the way, just so you know, the richest country in the world per population is not the United States, it's not Great Britain, it's not Germany, it's Qatar. This tiny little appendage over there right on the ocean. And I think the average income for the average person there is about $127,000 a year, but it's all about natural gas. They have one of the largest natural gas fields in the world, and now they're in a conflict with Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates and their neighbors. But no way in the world are they going to get water. Almost everything has to be imported. Their produce comes from one country. Their dairy comes from a different country. But that's true of Saudi Arabia. It's true of Lebanon. It's true of most of Israel. So the whole Middle East now is virtually unsustainable in the future. Half of Africa, unsustainable in the future. So if you've got all these places, and that's without the feedback loops, now here comes the kick. According to two people I've interviewed who are both Professor Emeritus's and both really knowledgeable, and one's the most knowledgeable person in the world about the Arctic, they're saying we're going to lose the Arctic sea ice probably in the next 4 to 8 weeks. And when we do, an enormous amount of heat's going to go on in the Arctic. You're going to have methane coming out. That's going to create even more heat in the atmosphere, which causes more global warming. and that can tip us way above two degrees, which was the threshold we could not go beyond. Without anyone doing anything, we're going to get there. And then people are going to say, well, why didn't we plan on this? Well, the government couldn't figure this. They had to have 73 million studies, as all bureaucracies have to do. That's just so irresponsible. So if you think your governments are going to take care of you, they're not. They're going to take care of themselves. They've spent almost $1 trillion creating almost fortress-like conditions for those who run the world, the oligarchs, the top 1%. You and I, we're left behind. If you think state governments are going to do it, they're not. No one is looking out for your interest, not even the so-called environmental groups out there. I wish they were, but they're not. So, in fact, I'll save it for my next program. I'll give you the organizations that I believe could do some good. Well, there are some really good ones. Let me tell you the good ones. I want to give you something to feel good about. Greenpeace is doing a good job. Union of Concerned Scientists, a good job. Idle No More, the Occupy Environmental equivalent. Many American Canadian Native tribes are part of that. Friends of the Earth, good. Center for Biological Diversity, good. And there are numerous small and local community and county and regional organizations fighting fracking and pipelines, deforestation, pollution, and mining. Here are the ones I do not support, the Sierra Club. Why? Because they collude with federal agencies to sue and settle lawsuits to earn revenues. They have double standards on fossil fuel alternatives and flip-flop on natural gas and fracking issues. They've been criticized for abusing the Endangered Species Act. The Environmental Defense Fund. They receive funds from McDonald's, Walmart, KKR, the Carlyle Group. And on their board of trustees, it's represented by Johnson & Johnson, Morgan Stanley, and the Clinton Climate Initiative, and Pepsi-Cola. The Natural Resource Defense Fund, big green organization, formerly aligned with 350, and it partnered with Synergo, the world's largest dumping sewage sludge on farms and gardens, and the board of and officers include the Rockefellers and Warner Brothers and Carlyle. 350.org, sorry, but Bill McKibben is not, in my personal opinion, a person who's going to be leading any of these crusades. And they're aligned with the Energy Action Coalition, which is connected with Al Gore and the Soros Open Society. And also, if you're getting funds from polluters, don't accept that money. And then the World Wildlife Fund, they are funded by Citigroup, Bank of America, J.P. Morgan, Philip Morris, DuPont, Paul Getty, Kodak, Bank of Tokyo, HSBC, and the National Audubon Society with over 100 large corporate givers. So those that are getting their money and possibly influenced by big corporations, I do not support those that don't that I gave you earlier. I do. So we're going to have to do a lot more, and I'm going to give a lot of what we can do on upcoming programs. I'm not seeing right now. Again, I'm not in our regular studio, and my connection in between. I don't see that we have any calls. If we have any calls, I want my engineer to let me know, and we'll be happy to go to your call. Do we have no calls? All right. And let me just finish off by this on the environment. Right now, we have a world that is getting to points where you're going to see irreversible feedback loops. I'll give you one example. There is a big shelf called the Larsen C Shelf. It is like a giant iceberg, but it's attached to land. And it's over 110 miles long, 3/4 mile deep, about 300 feet wide. And it breaks off. It's going to be about the size of Delaware. And when it breaks off, all that snow and ice that it was holding back is at a big angle, and it's going to start calving into the ocean. And once it starts, that is a feedback loop that no power on earth can stop. And as it accelerates, then more and more behind it, coming down a hill, will increase. And you could see what they would say, oh, we won't have that melt for another 100 years. They can be right. But when you remove what was backstopping it from falling into the ocean, now they're in chaos theory. And we could see a 10, 20-foot increase in the ocean waters in a period of months. So that's a big one. The melting of the Arctic ice cap is tipping. Greenland is becoming a big free flow of water into the North Atlantic, and the disintegration of the West Antarctic sheet. We get the El Ninos becoming more permanent. the disruption of the Indian West African monsoon. The permafrost is melting. The tundra is melting, releasing vast quantities of methane. The desertification all around the world. The Arctic ozone hole is increasing. Loss of rainforest, especially in the Amazon, and the loss of boreal forest. So those are some of the reasons why you must become involved personally. Do not wait for these non-committed groups to actually do something. We have to focus. Now, what can we do? I'll give you that information on our next program. Thank you all for listening. We're out of time. Have a nice day, everyone. I long to hold you tight, 'cause I